A father walks into a homeless shelter in Boston, demanding a bed. He has ID, he has attitude, and he has one bizarre claim. His son works here. Hours later, when Jonathan Flynn shows up for intake, Nick Flynn, the son who spent years telling people his father is dead, must watch the stranger raise his arms to be frisked like any other guest. No dramatic music plays. No reunion unfolds. Just another Tuesday night in a place where broken lives come to rest. This is the peculiar genius of Nick Flynn's memoir. It transforms an impossible coincidence into something far more unsettling, a meditation on how we inherit not just our parents' features, but their absences, their addictions, and sometimes their delusions. Some children grow up with too much father. Nick grew up with a name. Around the dinner table sat three people bearing Flynn, all connected to a man who wasn't bare. This absence carved itself into Nick's identity, like water wearing down stone, slowly, inevitably reshaping everything. When people asked about his father, Nick cycled through convenient fictions: dead, missing, somewhere down south. None were exactly lies. All were simpler than the truth. Jonathan Flynn existed primarily as mythology. According to his tales, the Flynns had invented life rafts and power windows, stayed wealthy through the Depression with a roofing company that secured contracts for Boston landmarks. Inside the grasshopper weather vane atop Faneuil Hall, you'd find his great-grandfather's name, Thaddeus. Specific enough to sound true, grand enough to seem absurd. But Jonathan had been real once. Barracuda buck, native guide in summers, a charter boat worker in winters, fancying himself the next great American poet. When he met 17-year-old Jody at a Scituate Harbor coffee shop, disaster was inevitable. She was wealthy but rebellious, he was charming but unreliable. When she got pregnant, her father arranged a meeting at prestigious Loch Ober. Jonathan agreed to marry her and abandon his nomadic life. Fatherhood didn't anchor him. By the time Nick was born, his 20-year-old mother had packed up both children and left. Jonathan's father-in-law set him up as president of European Engineering, a Renault dealership in Belmont. After 2 years of failing to sell cars, the business closed. He became Trader John, selling used foreign cars until he started spending clients' money, assuming wealthy customers wouldn't notice missing payments. The arrests followed. First, he stole the Palm Beach sheriff's car during toxic amnesia, driving it like a taxi while blacked out. 5 weeks in the stockade, then 6 months hard labor. He imagined emerging with his prison novel, his Dostoevsky. Later came forged checks, the first under his real name, later ones as Millard Fillmore. He claimed characters named Dippy Doo Doyle and Suitcase Fiddler had recruited him, threatening his children. After prison, Jonathan created the Fact Foundation of America, Inc., a dummy corporation with letterhead showing an open book pierced by a quill. He listed himself as president, founder, and sole member. Eventually evicted, he lived in his taxi, driving triple shifts. When he lost his hack license after another blackout, he walked everywhere, to his P.O. box, his storage unit, the bar for soup. Finally, he found himself standing over a steam grate where another homeless man slept, the hot air from the library creating an invisible room of warmth. While Jonathan drifted, Nick carved his own route through the world. Growing up in Scituate, Time magazine's second highest alcohol-consuming community, Nick absorbed drinking culture by osmosis. His mother pointed out bars his grandfather was banned from. His grandmother sent him to fetch her half gallon of Turner's Special Blend. After his mother married Travis, a Vietnam vet, Nick witnessed trauma's aftermath. Travis hotwiring boats, stealing lumber, showing them his war photo album, villages burning, corpses, faces without eyes. At 17, Nick sometimes drank with his mother, who believed you should never trust anyone who doesn't drink. After high school, he worked at Tony's Fish Pier until receiving a full scholarship to the University of Massachusetts. The carpenter advised him not to be an asshole. He had his whole life to work. Then came the impossible coincidence. In 1981, Nick met Emily in creative writing class at Boston University. When they reunited after summer break, she had someone new. At a house party, she told stories about her family's peculiar friend, a perpetually drunk, failed writer who'd tried picking up his ex-wife without recognizing her, served time in federal prison, and claimed to have written an unpublished masterpiece called The Button Man. Nick felt the blood drain from his face. She was talking about his father, a man Nick had seen perhaps a dozen times, but who had been a fixture in Emily's family life for years. After his mother's 1984 suicide, Nick worked at Boston's Pine Street Inn Homeless Shelter, a Sienese tower replica housing 300 to 600 men nightly. He started in the cage, distributing bed tickets through steel mesh amid smoke and anxiety. In housing, men exchanged tickets for plastic bins, stripped naked, and surrendered clothes to the hot room, a 180-degree sauna killing bugs. Nick's real role, exterminator, applying Quell lotion to kill lice and scabies. Most residents had survived war, prison, or both. One spoke through a throat hole. Junkies had festering wounds. Epileptics needed medication. As winter approached, the brown lobbies swelled from 30 to over 100 packed bodies. Then in 1989, the unthinkable. Captain told Nick a man claiming to be his father demanded a bed. Hours later, Jonathan appeared. Just another, new guest, raising his arms to be searched. Nothing was said between them. For nearly 20 years, Jonathan identified as a writer without writing much beyond cocktail napkin notes. He pointed to framed rejection letters as proof, one describing his work as a virtuoso display of personality whose dosage would kill hardier readers. He claimed he needed 12 desks for 12 chapters, inspired by Solzhenitsyn, and insisted, "It's all written, every word," yet evaded showing anything concrete, waiting for a $2 million advance because Kissinger got $2 million and Kissinger isn't even a writer. In summer 2000, Jonathan handed Nick four binders, 400 pages, that turned out to be a musical beginning with clink, clank, clunk, I think that I am drunk, dated February 15, 1964, the day after he stole the sheriff's car. For 30 pages, it showed promise, borrowed tones from Salinger, but soon fell apart into incoherence. After 12 years of stable housing, Jonathan attacked a neighbor with his cab club over loud music. When Nick arrived to confiscate it, Jonathan was drunk with no memory of the incident. He exploded, brandishing the club near Nick's head while screaming, "What do you think I am, a homicidal maniac?" He followed Nick into the hallway, screaming, "Father murderer," at his back. Days later, surprisingly calm, Jonathan handed over the club, thanking Nick for trying to help. After months researching at the U.S. Patent Office, Nick discovered something stunning. His grandfather really did invent a new and useful life raft in 1918, with improvements patented in 1942. His invention was used by seven countries during both World Wars. This part of his father's story was actually true. When Nick brought his father his first published poetry collection, Jonathan turned it over as if it's a holy relic before declaring, "Christ, I'm being beaten by my own son at poetry." Then immediately, "I've been in touch with Little Brown. They're doing my book, 4 million. They said it's a masterpiece." On one of their final visits, Jonathan answered the door with a gashed, swollen eye, boasting about beating up two cocksuckers. Before Nick left, his father proudly pointed to a tree. "See that tree? I'm responsible for that. I made a call, got the city to plant it. My tree. Then the steps they sat on. My steps." And finally, leaning into Nick's car window, "That tree too, even though it's not in front of my door." I was feeling generous. Perhaps the book had been standing before Nick all along, his father himself, constructed entirely of stories. The only book ever written about Jonathan Flynn was this one, the book that fell to Nick, his uncredited, non-compliant ghostwriter. We don't choose our inheritance, the absence, the addiction, the mythology, but we do choose what we build from it. Nick transformed his father's delusions into truth, giving Jonathan the literary immortality he craved but could never achieve himself.